distance. I mean, I live in an area where the houses were put up in the late 50s, and they all had clotheslines, and I used them to anchor some of my antennas, but I haven't seen an actual operational clothesline in the backyard for many years. They've everyone's kind of moved on to internal dryers.
I remember visiting relatives in Brooklyn and working in Brooklyn. I was actually born in Brooklyn. And there was lots of clotheslines between the back of your building and the building on the opposite side of the street, or the opposite side of the block, I suppose is a better way to describe it. There's got to be some of them still left around. And there's some room for play in there, I think.
Yeah, probably. I mean, like I said before, there's loads of poles in the backyard, but I haven't seen an actual clothesline with clothing flapping in the breeze for maybe 20 years.
Understood. Then just one comment to follow.
Sure.
Moving around the bands a bit, not as much as some of you folks, but I got to appreciate Roy's ability to do a, it's hard to describe, semi-formal or casual, or the way he runs the net is just so pleasant and adaptable and versatile, and everybody can participate in their way. But some folks seem to think that it's like walking in the door, Kramer walking in the door. Hey! It's kind of silly. Have some formality. Roy does a great job organizing this thing. Don't be Kramer. And back to that. What a grin.
Thank you, Jim. I consider this an informal net, but it's still a net control operator-directed net. So, you know, occasionally I kind of lose the control, especially there was one day where I kind of got stuck in Echolink, and because everyone was quick keying, I was never able to actually use that connection. One of the many reasons why I don't use Echolink, I use Allstar. But thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Someone else doubled. Did they want to say something?
This is Brian again. You know, it brings back a very, very funny story. When I was about 12 years old, living in Canarsie at that time, in a different area of Canarsie, I had neighbors that had clotheslines. And my neighbor was an extremely, extremely good-looking woman. And she would go ahead, I would wait every other day when she would put out her lingerie on the clothesline to dry. Let me tell you something. That brought back good memories, so thank you.
Well, I'm glad it brought back good memories. You know, I'm trying to think back. I really, you know, when I was younger, you know, I just saw clothing flapping away. I don't know. I didn't get that much out of it personally, but, you know, I mean, I had my Sears catalog. You know, if I wanted to be a weird little young voyeur, I could use the Sears catalog. It probably was a much sharper resolution.
That's very funny. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Oh, the Sears catalog. I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I have fond memories about that. I remember how thick that damn thing was. You know, it was thicker than the average telephone directory.
I think there's a website online that you could look over all the old Sears and Radio Shack catalogs.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. I was a big fan for Lafayette catalogs as well. I was very, very sad when I heard that they had gone out of business many years ago. They put out a very nice electronic supply catalog.
I remember something because my, was first interested in RF. On the most basic level, I picked up a three-channel walkie-talkie from Lafayette in downtown Brooklyn. So I I do remember that.
Yeah, a lot of hams have nice memories about Lafayette. Less have good memories about Radio Shack. I treated Radio Shack as a place to get free batteries.
That's pretty funny. That and other things. But Lafayette was very interesting. And in those days, just even getting into what was then was the good part of CP Radio, I needed a license too. So they wouldn't sell it without one.
Well, that's good of them. I don't know. Unfortunately, I only went to Lafayette personally once in my life when I was a kid. My father brought me there because I was putting together a photoelectric alarm system, and I needed a potentiometer. And the salesperson either didn't understand me or was trying to rob me blind. So instead of showing me some 50-cent a PC board potentiometer, he tried to sell me a audio L-pad audio attenuator. They would cost me $12 or something. So, I don't know. I have mixed memories as far as the Lafayette store are concerned.
I believe they were based in Syosset.
Yep. I can see it in my mind's eye. Syosset, Long Island.
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
In my youth, 10 years old to teens, I had the pleasure of being in a bicycle distance of a shopping center that had both a Lafayette and a Radio Shack in the exact same shopping center on Route 25 in Coram. I forget how long it was they coexisted, but it was object of much desire that I could not attain.
Yeah, that must have been fun. I don't know. I had a lot of more experiences, obviously, with Radio Shack because they had a lot more stores and they survived much longer. But I was kind of discouraged that the salespeople that they chose to give jobs to were kind of electronically illiterate. They pretty much were there to hawk the radios and later on the cell phones. I remember a long time ago I went into a Radio Shack and I asked where they had the light-emitting diodes. And, of course, the response from the sales clerk was, "What?" Didn't have a clue what that was. So, I don't know. Like I said, I only experienced one Lafayette salesperson and he tried to rob me. But I assume he understood a little bit better than the average sales help at Radio Shack. I don't know where they got those guys, but they tended to know as little as possible about electronics.
They skipped over geeks and went right to dweebs.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I mean, way back at the very beginning, they were really into different types of selling your radios. But then I think it was about 95 maybe or 2000, it kind of suddenly overnight changed to a cell phone company.
They were just trying to, at that point, tread water.
Yeah, I assume they thought that's where the money was. Obviously it wasn't because they drowned. Jim, please, tell me your story.
In my shack, my garage, there's, on the left side, a black Radio Shack Minimus 7 speaker, and on the right side, there's a white Minimus 7 speaker, Radio Shack. They look the same as a bazillion 1980s versions of Minimus small speakers, but oddly enough, Radio Shack knocked it out of the park with these Minimus 7 speakers. And they literally have a cult following. Both of these I've repaired. The lead that goes to the speaker cone broke, and I re-soldered it with no great knowledge, just a will to make the thing work. And these little speakers sound amazing. way, way better than you would think you would get out of a junkie. And so the reason is a white and a red one, a white one and a black one, is they were the store samples. You could buy a set of black speakers or a set of white speakers. This was one of each. As they were going out of business, a buddy of mine bought it. I have them in my shack. Boy, do they sound nice. Most of their speakers were really junk. Back to Roy.
Comment N1YDY.
Yes, hi.
Back when I was a really young kid, I don't know if I was in high school or still in grammar school, I don't remember, but my father wanted to buy a CB, and he asked his friend, who was an engineer at Grumman, whether he should buy one CB or another that were available at Radio Shack and Lafayette, respectively, and the Grumman engineer took both of us, took my father, and my father took me, and basically told him that if you're going to buy those kinds of products, that you should buy it from Lafayette because it's a better made product in Japan than the comparably priced product from Radio Shack in that time frame. And somehow or another, my parents have moved three or four times, and this old 23-channel CB is still following us around, and it works. I mean, I've turned it on every now and then, and it works. I have replaced a couple of caps in it over the years for my dad, who's no longer with us. But the engineer made a point of telling my dad that this thing would last longer than anything he bought from Radio Shack. And I think he was right.
I think the problem with Radio Shack, it was the ultimate game of Russian roulette. As far as I've been able to piece it together, they had no particular loyalty. They would just go to any manufacturer, and if they could get the price down, they'd have it rebranded realistic. Sometimes it was decent, sometimes it was crap. They especially had a very distorted idea of quality when it came to coaxial cables. I remember seeing Radio Shack coaxial coaxial cables that were literally something like three or four little pieces of copper wire was the shielding in some cases. So you got sometimes like Jim said, you know, the speaker was fantastic. That was random dumb luck, I think, on the part of Radio Shack. Most of the time, they just went for the cheapest sourcer.
Agreed. Another example?
Sure.
So the Radio Shack CBs, most of them were kind of junky. I had one or two. I had a base with like a clock on it. It was silly. But the one thing I still to this day remember, and I will never just change my mind. The Radio Shack blocky microphone that they sold with most of their radios absolutely felt perfect in my hand. Perfect. There's no equal to the feel of that thing. When you press the button, you knew you were transmitting. It wasn't like, am I pressing it hard enough? You absolutely knew. And it was just in the right, it just worked perfect. The ergonomics of it belied by the blockiness of the look of the thing. It worked terrific. Mechanically. But electronically and audio-wise, I don't even know. But aesthetically, you know, ergonomically, it was perfect.
WA2VS.
Yeah?
Yes, good evening, everybody. Good evening, Jim. Years ago, I had tons of Radio Shack scanners, and they were wonderful. I've had them for years and years. I don't, of course, listen to scanners anymore. But I do recall spending, I think, $250, even $300 on Radio Shack scanners, and they were terrific.
Yeah, but again, they changed manufacturers without telling anyone abruptly, and so it was kind of Russian roulette. Yeah, someone else wants to make a comment?
Oh, it's Brian. When I worked for Radio Shack during my undergraduate days, part-time, they were made by Unison for the most part. And then also they were made by the other company. What is it again? Wildcat? No, no, no. I'm wrong. It's something along those lines.
Bearcat, maybe.
Made a lot of medical products.
Bearcat.
What was the name of that company?
Was it Bearcat?
Bearcat, thank you.
It was also Max Kramer.
Was actually really good. Some of that stuff was actually quite good. But they had a lot of stuff that was relatively poor as well.
Yeah, and it was subject to change, unfortunately. Just because they happened to buy from a decent manufacturer 1 year didn't mean that when you walk in the door, you could get something with a very similar appearance but built like crap. Okay, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure as always. I appreciate all of your participation in this, and we went back in the end to nostalgia. Our lovely little electronic stories that taught us little bits and pieces of electronic theory. So I thank you all, and I think it's a perfect time to turn it over to Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy.
Very good, Roy. And it's Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report. I'm looking at a Mikrata clock that I got from Radio Shack many, many years ago. Digital clock. It's big. I mean, the LED is probably about 2.5-inch numbers on the clock. Still going. Got it set for UTC. Anyway, the rocket that was launched a while back, a couple of weeks ago, with New Glenn, it sent up a couple of satellites that are supposed to go to Mars, and they are doing well. They're called Escapade, and right now they're hanging out at the L2 location, and they'll be there for almost a year. Until Mars gets, within range of the Earth. Every 27 months they get close to one another. And at that point, both satellites, there were two Escapade satellites, will ignite their engines and head off to Mars. It'll take, another 6 to 8 months to get there. And then they'll eventually go into an elliptical orbit around Mars. And it will take time to lower the orbit. And they won't actually still, 2000, looking at the date. About 2.5 years from now, they'll start their science mission. They work. And it's something to look forward to. The most important part of that whole flight, though, was the New Glenn rocket, which successfully took off. For the first time, they were able to actually land on a drone ship and successfully bring that back. And now that's being checked out. They will eventually refly that one again. So we'll see. Escapade is an interesting two satellites. And they did not really get much airtime because of the rocket itself. Monster rocket, about four times the size of, Falcon 9 rocket, volume-wise. So we'll see. There's going to be a lot happening in the future with that rocket, called the New Glenn. Any comments?
KD2VHG.
Good evening, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I know you speak mostly of human endeavors into space, but you haven't spoke much about this odd thing flying around in our solar system. Hope you get to that tonight.
talking about the Atlas, what is it, the 3i Atlas.
I believe that's what they call it.
Okay, yeah. I know that's on the news a lot. Yeah, 3i. Interstellar object that's ever been detected over the last couple of years. You know, we have great telescopes worldwide now, and eventually, sooner or later, one of these things will pick it up. The Atlas telescopes, I believe there's three or four different locations around the Earth.
I gotta go to the bathroom.
I think it was the one in Spain that picked up this comet as it was flying, into and eventually out of the solar system. So that's why they call it Atlas, and then the 3i is the third interstellar comet flying through the solar system. But the reason it's making so much news is, well, I think the first one too, one that was discovered from a Hawaii telescope a couple of few years ago, made a lot of news too. They hype it up, saying, well, it's under its own power, or there's reasons to believe that, this thing was put here from an intelligent species, and the shape of it, as long as the Empire State Building, and, it's shaped like a giant rectangle. They go on and on. There could be maybe intelligent life on it, and the reason they come up with this whole theory is, a couple of people read books years ago, like me. And if you read the book by Arthur C. Clarke, Rendezvous with Rama, actually it's a great book. It kind of follows the same type of thing. In this book, well, it's the first time an interstellar object has entered the solar system. And naturally, well, we have to find out what's there. And they send a group of astronauts out to investigate it. They want to not only land on it, they want to land in it. In this case, it's a gigantic sphere in the book. Big, long sphere. And it's rotating. And by rotating, it's creating gravity and on and on and on. Anyway, I highly recommend reading that book. By the way, I think within a couple of years, there's talk about making a book about Rendezvous with Rama. So we'll see. But good story. And, I haven't really talked about that much. I think somebody mentioned it a couple of months ago. About a month or so ago. Back to you, Jeff.
I'm chuckling about what a big, long sphere looks like. Not to get technical. Wink, wink. But seriously, can you tell us anything about this thing from your perspective?
Well, it's got some iron. Was it iron and nickel? They've done spectroscopy on it, and that's what it came out. So it's I forget the dimensions, but it's on the long side, and so was the first one. And I expect them to find a lot more of these in the future. And it's moving at high speed. It's averaging through the solar system at like 150,000 miles an hour. Speed is getting up to when it gets close to the sun. And if you do the math on whatever the speed is that they figured out, they know that anything to get up that speed could not have come from the solar system. The solar system would not have the capability of pushing something along at this incredible speed. But if it came from outside the galaxy and something else had pushed it at an, you know, an initial speed, when it gets close to the sun, instead of, you know, getting up to, you know, a normal speed that a comet might encounter, it's way above that. So they know that, therefore, this thing has come from outside of the solar system. Back to you, Jeff.
So it's a real oddball. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. The one from Hawaii was, I think that was 2021. And then there was one after that, and now this one. So, yeah, it's the third one that we've detected in the last couple of years. Now, you could imagine how many more of these things that might have flown through, you know, in the past 10 years or past 100 years, but we just never detected it.
So there's been some talk that it comes from the area where the WOW signal that was detected in, I think, the 70s, comes, you know, it came from that direction. Is there anything to that claim?
I haven't heard that one. But, yeah, they're going to pick up on a lot of this. And I don't know. I have no idea if that's a true statement or not. But it's a good one. That will keep good people thinking. You know, yeah, that was what, I think you're right, around 1977 or so. They marked that off on a computer sheet coming out of a printer. Somebody wrote the word WOW because, you know, it had the characteristics of being a signal that could have, possible communication capability because of the location and the strength that came here. Since then, I think they found out, somebody figured out it could have been a couple of came close by one another and hit each other or some kind of a story. But, the WOW signal I can't remember the details, has pretty much been resolved over the years, you know. So I put that in there. Not possible category, not probable category in my head. Back to you.
Comment.
Go ahead.
Oh, it's Brian, KF2CZ. I wonder if it's the obelisk from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, I was waiting for somebody to come up with that. Let's see, what was the dimension to that? It was the cube of the first three numbers. So you take 1, 2, and 3. So the dimensions were 1 by 6 by... was it 9 or some kind of a number that they came up with for that thing. I think it was the cube of the first three numbers of 1, 2, and 3. So yeah, maybe this thing has got that shape. Is that what you're saying, Brian?
Oh, I was just listening along, so I figured I need a little bit of humor. Yeah.
Yeah, I only wish it was. Then we could really talk about something good instead of rockets. Any other comments, Jim, or anybody else?
Not for me. It sounds like there's not much that we have to add, but definitely got one eyeball on it. Maybe half an eyeball. But it seems odd. I don't know what to make of it. Back to the space then.
Oh, I know what it is.
Yeah, and I recommend Rendezvous with Rama. It's really a good book. You know, especially because of the these three interstellar objects that have flown by in the last 3 or 4 years. Very good. Okay, I wanted to talk about the Starliner mission. Starliner mission is the one that took Sonny Williams and the other fellow, Butch Williams, up to the International Space Station. They spent 9 months on the space station. They thought they were going to spend 8 days. And it was because the thrusters were not working properly, and they didn't want to take a chance of putting a crew back onto that vehicle and bringing it back to Earth. Turned out, by the way, they eventually did bring that vehicle back to Earth, and it landed safely on ground where it was supposed to, exactly where it was supposed to, in White Sands, New Mexico. If you had a crew on there, it would have been fine. But better to be safe than sorry. The crew stayed on board and eventually came back on a Dragon vehicle that they sent up with two people on board. Usually they sent four people up. They left two seats empty for Butch and Sonny to come back on, which they did. But the Starliner itself, it was working on it, looking into its problems. Boeing believes that they have it all solved, and they plan on launching it again, but without a crew. We want another test flight, so that's what they plan on doing. So they're going to use it as a cargo vehicle. They're going to bring, you know, tons of stuff up, whatever they need for the crews on the space station. And they plan on doing that in the next couple of months. My guess is probably, you know, late March, maybe April. After that, if all is well, they bring it back safely, then probably in October of next year, they will use it for, you know, a crew to go up and exchange with a crew that is on board the station. So they originally had a contract with NASA for 6 flights. Crewed flights, and so far they only had, let's call it a half a flight. You know, they brought two people up for a test and they didn't come back. There's a possibility before the space station is retired in probably 2030 that they could have as many as 3 flights on the Starliner, but it's, you know, it's not over for Boeing. That goes to plan and everything works out okay. They could use it for future space stations, and there's multiple space stations being planned and worked on as we speak. So hopefully by 2030 or soon after, there'll be places for all of these spacecraft to visit. You know, you have Dragon capability, which has a cargo vehicle, crew vehicle. You have Japan now with the HTVX, which is now presently docked to the International Space Station, very large vehicle. Does not have a crew capability, but, you know, it's cargo. You have the Progress vehicle going up, but I think Russia is going to be out of the picture by that time. Of course, have the Soyuz vehicles that go up with crew. And I think they'll be, I don't think they're going to be part of future space stations. The Cygnus spacecraft also goes up, you know, without a crew. And the Sierra Nevada Corporation still has the Dream Chaser, which they're still developing. And that should go up
on a test flight early, maybe 4 or 5 months into next year. And I will do a flight, just an orbital flight, to test everything out. If everything works out good after that, they'll use that for cargo in the future, for the space station. Only time will tell. But all these vehicles will eventually, hopefully, have places to go to with all the multiple different space stations that are being developed. Any comments?
Question in one way, do you like?
Why? Go ahead, sure.
Yeah, I read somewhere that the Sierra Nevada vehicle will not be going to the ISS on its flight, and that there's no guarantee that it's going to go there, even if it does perform adequately or nominally when it does have that test flight. Do you know anything more about that?
Yeah, I've heard exactly what you've heard. But, you know, plans change. Administrations change. Who knows what's going to happen in the future with that thing. But it's under development. Like I was saying, that the first flight or test flight will not go to the space station. Presently, yeah, you're right. There's no plan of bringing it to the space station. But, you know, it has that capability of doing it. You know, if NASA changes their mind, and lately NASA and the administration change their mind overnight about everything, that could still be possible. But with all these other stations being developed, you have the orbital reef being built by Amazon. You have the first one that will go up, very small, is called Haven. Haven will be launched early next year. And they're heavily involved with SpaceX. So that will be just one module. SpaceX will go up and visit it with a crew of four. The SpaceX vehicle will stay attached to that space station because it only has one port, not two ports. So that'll stay attached to Haven. Crew will live there for a period of time, probably a couple of weeks or more, and then they will fly back on Dragon. Yeah, Haven has future plans of multiple modules, and they'll eventually attaching them to, you know, one to another. And then they'll have multiple ports, so they'll be able to bring up, you know, a spacecraft and cargo vehicles. So, you know, as the European Space Agency is developing their own space station and partners with a company called Voyager. Voyager is planning on building a massive space station that will not be modular. It will go up in one shot. They plan on launching it on a Starship. You know, these are all present plans. They're working on it, and, you know, if it happens, it happens. We'll see. Let's see. Back to you. WSUN here.
Thank you, Paul. And one way to my clear.
1x4x9.
Okay, thanks, YDY. And Brian, what was the dimensions of the of that thing?
The monolith is 1x4x9.
Okay, so it was the square of the first three numbers. Yeah, that thing was all over the place. It was on the moon, it was floating around. In the movie, in the book, it was different. You know, in the movie, it was going around Jupiter. supposed to be sad. Anyway, last couple of words Dave spoke was, oh my God, it's full of stars. Remember that?
I thought he said something to the effect like, you know, how? Is there a Taco Bell around here?
Yeah, yeah, copy that. Yeah. Anyway, that was one of the better movies. And then they had a follow-up movie, and that was no bargain. Was it 2011? Okay. Just wanted to mention the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is the one that we covered here on quite a bit. That was the one that went out to Bennu. Asteroid picked up a whole bunch of stuff with its arm. It had an arm that reached out to the asteroid. The arm was called TAG, stood for touch and go. So reached out, had this pneumatic charge inside of it, and it forced the any of the regolith that was on the asteroid, you know, by giving it a blast of nitrogen, stuff would fly up and it would get sucked into this container. And I think the container was around 12 inches in diameter or so. And it eventually sealed itself off inside of the spacecraft into the descent module. I think flew eventually back to Earth, past Earth. And the set module separated and wound up coming back down into the ESAR proving ground. So it came through with heat shields and parachutes. They eventually recovered stuff inside with a lot of problems. They did have problems probably opening, I think. But they eventually did. OSIRIS-REx kept going. You know, in orbit, you know, around the sun. But now it's back for a visit. In fact, it just came flying past Earth, a couple of thousand miles above the surface of the Earth. And the reason for doing that is they plan on redirecting it to another asteroid called Apophis. They needed to change the inclination of its flight by 1.5 degrees. They also wanted to increase the speed by, I read 15,000 miles an hour, by using Earth as a gravitational assist. When I say that speed, that's relationship to going around the sun, not Earth. But it will increase that orbital speed, and by doing that and changing its trajectory, at some time in the future it will come across Apophis, and they plan on getting close to it. I don't think they plan on orbiting it. I'll have to look into that, but eventually they plan on taking close-up views of Apophis. That's the reason they got involved with Apophis is some years ago, they thought Apophis had a possibility of hitting Earth in the future. But eventually, they did the math, threw away that calculated, and they probably used the slide rule and figured out, well, no, it's not going to hit Earth. But it's going to, you know, relatively be close. And it's on the large side. It is on the large side, worth taking a look. Now they don't have another descent module on board, so they can't duplicate what they did on Bennu, but they can take close-up pictures. They can, you know, figure out what it's made out of, you know, with the detectors that they have on board. And the cameras are still operating. The last time the cameras were used was to take a picture of the descent module, make sure all the regular, that they had picked up was properly sealed, which it was. But they could still use those cameras, and they took pictures as they were flying past Earth, and then I think in a couple of weeks or so, they're going to turn the spacecraft around, face it back toward Earth, and take a picture of the Earth and Moon at the same time. And then after that, they'll be on the way to Apophis. That's the story with the OSIRIS-REx, renamed, by the way, to OSIRIS-REx Apex. The Apex stands for Apophis Explorer. So you have the Origin Spectra Interpretation Resource Identification and Security Apophis Explorer. And I don't have that memorized. I did have to read that. Any comments?
Well, I'm very interested in what you said. Didn't they detect amino acids from that encounter with the asteroid?
I don't remember. I know they detected amino acids on something. I don't know if they were comets or other asteroids or this asteroid, but I will look into that, Brian.
I think they found that's the one that touched the asteroid and then bounced off of it, you know, had a, return to Earth, and they were analyzing some of the pieces of rock, and they found evidence of another amino acid. I think it was tryptophan, or one of those that was necessary for life, or as we know it. And I forgot which spacecraft that was, but it was the one, obviously, the probe that separated from the object that would go ahead and touch the asteroid briefly, and then get off, and then eject the capsule containing the sample, return that to Earth.
Okay, yeah, well, that was definitely that OSIRIS-REx did do that with Bennu, but there were other missions, so, like Japan did two missions with Hayabusa, similar type of thing. They only got like a gram or two. We got like, you know, a couple of pounds of stuff. I don't know which one detected amino acids or both of them did. But yeah, I'll look into it. That should be easy enough to find, Brian. Yeah. There's been a lot of different missions to investigate different things. I remember Stardust launched in the late 90s, went out to a comet. Comet Wolf, and it got near the comet, and it had this they call it an aerogel mint that was about the size of a tennis racket that came out of the spacecraft, and picked up the different molecules that were being emitted from the comet. So then again, this aerogel tennis-sized mint eventually folded up on the side of a return descent capsule as well, and that came flying back down through the atmosphere. And, when they looked into that, they found interesting things that I can't remember if one of them was amino acids, but we'll look into that. Thanks for that, Brian.
No problem. And also, I don't know if you touch on this stuff, but NASA has its X-59 supersonic aircraft prototype that they were testing again recently, and they got it up to about, I think, Mach 1 or something like that. I'm not sure. Maybe it was sub speed. And they worked really well. I don't know if you know about that at all, because I didn't read too much about it, but it's a research aircraft.
Yeah, that's a Quest plane that they've developed. They've got one big honking engine on the back of it. And they were able to eventually fly it at 1.3 Mach. And that's what they want to do in the future. And they're going to fly it over land to see the results. What's heard on the ground, you know, the idea is to soften the sonic boom is so quiet where it's not noticeable. But they've gone through a series of tests since completing it. You know, they take their time. They originally took it out and they just towed it around on the runway, put it back in the hangar. Eventually they took it out and they flew it, only went for, you know, a short flight. Came back, you know, 10, 15 minutes. And this last flight, I think you're talking about, they got it up to 35,000 feet. Flew it at, you know, probably 400 or 500 miles an hour. They have not gone through the sound barrier yet. I haven't read that one yet. But that's coming up very shortly, I think. And then once they do, they plan on actually flying a route probably out west somewhere, where they've done the same thing with the fighter jet. You know, they've gone through where they've taken readings, what it normally sounds like, and then the X-59 will follow the same path, and they'll make comparisons. And it does work out. You know, it's open source, you know, by NASA. Companies want to, you know, copy the design and eventually make commercial planes do the same thing. That will be up to them. There's a company called Boom. They have a plane, I think, with that name, which is, I think, a terrible name, but the idea is they'll be able to fly faster than the speed of sound. But they're duplicating what Concorde did. They do not have plans of flying over ground, just water, you know, over the ocean. So the planes will be a lot smaller than Concorde. Same idea that, you know, I guess some billionaire is going to buy this thing up and they're going to fly back and forth over the ocean with it. That's the company. The company's called Boom. God awful name. Any other comments, Brian?
No, you are correct. The company that was, well, this, the X-59 is from NASA, but the Boom is another company with its own, take on supersonic flight as passengers. I believe United Airlines invested in and put some percentage of income to the development.
Really? That's interesting. Okay. That means they're getting outside money.
No.
Hope it works out. You know, I thought it was great when we had the Concorde. I remember driving to work many times. They used to fly into New York. And sometimes in the daytime, you know, it was daytime and early in the morning, you would see this thing flying high above us as I was driving into the city, getting ready to land at Kennedy. That'll be fun. You know, and back then, I think it was, what, $1,300 or something to fly. In those days, that would be, you know, probably like $5,000, I guess, today. Maybe more. Anyway, I wanted to bring up one other topic before it's already getting late, and that has to do with the launch of three people up to the International Space Station on a Soyuz rocket. They launched successfully from Baikonur Cosmodrome down, you know, in Kazakhstan, right next to Russia. Same place that, you know, Yuri Gagarin launched, you know, all those decades ago. They still use that same launch complex to put people into space. Well, the spacecraft successfully docked with the International Space Station, no problem. They're there. There's two Russians and one American on board. The American, he'll take over being a doctor. You know, there's always a medical person on board. And, he'll be up there for 8 months, and he'll be doing that. The reason I think this flight was newsworthy, outside of the crew going to the space station,
that time
was
complete.
Because the rocket itself, when it took off, it completely destroyed the lower part of the launch complex at Baikonur. Gigantic platform that, you know, that they do work on. They bring equipment out there. Anyway, this platform couldn't take the vibration this time and wound up going down into the air. It looks like a crater. If you look at the Baikonur launch complex, it's a massive hole below the launch complex. It kind of like sticks out over this hole. And, you know, that's where the exhaust gets blown out. You know, with launch complexes like we have, there's flame directors that, you know, the flame comes down and, you know, they push it out one way or another. This is different. They just blow it straight down. Apparently, maybe there's not enough maintenance. Who knows the way things are going in Russia. You know, they've launched, you know, hundreds of rockets from the same location, and apparently nothing's happened. But this work table, was not maintained properly, or, you know, not sure the design was okay. It's been there for like forever, from what I understand. Wound up collapsing and going down to the hole. And now they're going to have to rebuild that. Now there's only one way for a crew right now to actually get to the space station. That's with the Dragon spacecraft. And, you know, other systems like Boeing with their Starliner, like I mentioned earlier, you know, that's on delay. They're going to run a test flight, but you only had two ways of getting to the space station, Dragon and Soyuz. And now Soyuz is going to be delayed. Russia does not have human launch capabilities from their other launch complexes. They have another one up north. You know, they launched their Proton rocket from. Then they have another launch complex in eastern Russia, which is Falconer, you know, not too far from Alaska. And they have a whole, like, small city built up over there to launch rockets. They have Soyuz rockets that go up. They have other capabilities, but they are not capable of launching people, and they don't have those facilities. So, I guess they're going to be a mad rush to fix that. But interesting thing, what's going on. You know, you have all these new companies being built up, and some of the other ones are, you know, falling away, literally. All right, any other last comments before I close and reach the witching hour here? WS2F.
Thanks for all you guys to say.
No, in
interesting.
Goodbye.
Always interesting. And
now I'll turn it back to Roy.
Thank you for your
that
nice presentation.
Tomorrow night.
And
Monday night, 8:30.
X-59.
Why am I going to have